The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we will call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. We do not have a quorum, so I guess we're not in order, but we will call it to order and take care of some housekeeping business here, if you will. As soon as we have a quorum, we have three bills before today, House File 61, 258, 62. And just so everyone knows, we will not be voting on the bills themselves. I'm not sure if there's some amendments. We would get maybe a technical author amendment here or there. Okay, so with that, Representative Anderson. Oh, we're doing MMB. Oh, I apologize. Okay. Presentation by Dr. Laura. Dr. Laura on tax volatility. May I refer to you as doctor?
Yes.
Just for the record, how do you pronounce your last name?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, I'm Dr. Laura Colombo-Ketis.
Thank you, doctor. Please present your testimony. And you're from MMB.
That's right. So I'm Laura Colombo-Ketis.
Excuse me. How's your new commissioner doing? Is he measuring up to your expectations?
Mr. Chairman, members of the... members of the committee, the new commissioner is a very quick study, especially with regard to taxes.
Yes, he's very good. Yes. Very good. Okay, thank you, doctor. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Again, I'm Laura Colombo-Ketis, and I'm the state economist, and I'm here today to talk about revenue volatility. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm pleased to be here. You should have a handout that includes a slide set, that the cover of which is says Minnesota revenue volatility. So if we look at the first slide of the deck, Minnesota's taxes make varying contributions to tax policy goals. This is not news to members of the tax committee, but I wanted to start with some of the principles of tax policy, because while I'm talking about revenue volatility today, it's only one of several important principles of tax policy. So the 2011 tax expenditure review study, of which I'm one of many authors, named three generally agreed upon guiding principles or goals of tax policy. Again, these are not unfamiliar to you. Along with generating adequate revenue, taxes should have a limited impact on economic decisions, which is the principle of economic efficiency. They should treat similarly situated people similarly, known as horizontal equity. And be simple to administer and comply with. So the study also cited several other relevant goals, including levying taxes according to taxpayers' ability to pay, or vertical equity, and having a stable source of revenue, which is the subject of today's presentation. So as you know, tax policy must balance all of these goals, many of which are often in conflict with one another. For example, a tax based on ability to pay may not be the simplest, and reducing dependence on a volatile revenue source may make it harder to generate adequate revenue. In addition, non-tax policies can be used to address some of the same goals. For example, income support programs can ease the burden of regressive taxes, and budget reserve policies can manage the risk of volatile revenues. So moving on to the next slide, talking about revenue volatility varying by source, MMB's revenue volatility analysis is based on a methodology developed by my predecessor, Professor Tom Stinson, and economic analysis staffer Matt Shepner, who's at MMB, for the 2008 State Budget Trend Study Commission. Since then, Stinson and Shepner, with input from John Peliquin of MMB, have updated that analysis to take into account more recent data, including the impact of the Great Recession. The analysis forms the basis of a report that MMB releases on January 15th of each year, recommending the size of the state budget reserve. So from that analysis, the table that you have in the second slide shows the growth rates, estimated volatility, and share of total general fund revenues for each major Minnesota general fund revenue source.
Doctor, if we could hold that thought there.
Yes.
We'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order as we have a quorum. The gentleman from Lyon, Representative Swinzinski, moves the minutes of January 21st. Any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thanks to the gentleman from Lyon. We will now continue the presentation before we get into bills. Please continue, Dr. Kalamovokidis.
What I do?
that's fine. Thank you.
Okay. thank you.
thank you,
I did
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I'm Laura Kalamovokidis, the state economist.
Kalumbo.
We'll get it eventually. I'll be here plenty of other times too. So from the analysis that Stinson and Scheffner developed and that our staff has expanded, you can see the chart that shows growth rates, revenue volatility as estimated revenue volatility, and share of total general fund revenues for major sources. To estimate the revenue volatility, we first measure the underlying trend growth rate. So that's the first column you see on that that table is the trend growth rate. In the revenue source, and then we observe the standard deviation from that trend, and so that's what the volatility measure is. The forecast shares of general fund revenues are shown for both the current and the next biennium. So what you can see from this, from the assemblage of data there, is that Minnesota's corporate tax is measured as the most volatile of the major sources, with an estimated volatility almost five times that of the general sales tax, which is one of the most stable revenue sources. The two taxes generate very different shares of total revenue, however, with the corporate tax making up only 6.8% of revenues compared to more than a quarter of revenues for the sales tax. While still relatively low compared to the corporate tax, the individual income tax, making up more than half of general fund revenues, is the second most volatile of the major sources. So overall general fund volatility, the 4.3% you see in the second column, depends on the volatility of the individual sources of revenue, the share of total revenue each tax contributes to the general fund, so sort of its weight within the general fund, and the whether the revenue sources tend to deviate from their trends in the same or opposite directions. And so, in other words, the correlations between the revenue sources. So it's the mix, but it's also the way these move with or against one another. That last condition is tied to the idea of a diversified portfolio, that you can have risky assets in a portfolio, but if they are negatively correlated with one another, then their deviations from trend can offset one another. Same kind of idea here. The corporate tax is nearly 2.5 times more volatile than the individual tax, but it generates a much smaller share of general fund revenues. So on a weighted basis, the corporate tax contributes less to general fund volatility than the income tax.
What page is she on now?
There's a Earhart. She's on page, what do you call it, two or three, depending on? Two?
It's the table, Mr. Chairman, it's the table titled Revenue Volatility and Growth Vary by Source.
That's what I thought, Mr. Chairman. I wasn't sure because I thought the language was getting away from me here. So.
Okay. Doctor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Doctor, just a quick question.
Sure.
On the volatility, the corporate franchise tax we all know is very volatile. But yet in the projections 14, 15, 16, 17, it's a half a point difference. If it's that volatile, why is it so flat?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. That's an interesting point, that the corporate tax does not, in our forecast, doesn't grow much between the biennia. And that had to do with, if I remember correctly, economic conditions and expectations for corporate profit growth through that time. So it was an economic factor. But you're right that there appears to be a relationship, and it's not always the case, but it's often the case that the sources that are the most volatile tend to have the highest trend growth rates. We just have the corporate tax below its historical trend growth rate in our forecast.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Chairman Knobloch.
Well, Mr. Chairman, to that point, Dr. Kalamovokidis, just out of curiosity, looking at the individual income tax, do you know the last time that it had 52% of the share of the state revenues? Has it ever had that much?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Knobloch, I don't know the answer to that at the moment.
Okay, well, thank you. It seems like that might be an interesting indicator of something to look out for if that's a situation where that tends to rise the fastest and then, I guess, probably fall off the most during recessions. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks.
Dr. Klumpkidis. Oh, Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you know how many, and I won't try to pronounce your name yet, but anyway, presenter, you know how many states have property taxes that feed their general fund?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, representative members of the committee, I don't know the answer to that. That's an interesting question, but I do not know.
Representative Earhart? Representative Earhart?
I just heard someone say that probably nobody knows.
Joel Michael.
Well, we have Joel Michael in the room, so somebody knows.
I am sorry. I forgot.
Mr.
He knows all, sees all.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know the answer to the either, so, but we can find out for you, Representative Earhart.
Ms. Manzi? That's an interesting question. I'd kind of like to know the answer to that, too, if we could get that. Representative Earhart?
No, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the fact that we don't know.
We don't know what we don't know. Dr. Kolumbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. So we talked about the fact that the volatility of the general fund is affected by the shares of the tax mix. It's affected by the volatility of the individual taxes. And so it is possible to change the volatility of the general fund by altering that tax mix. But I also talked about there's this relationship between the taxes and whether or not they are positively and negatively correlated. So that means that when you alter the tax mix, that those correlations can dampen or exacerbate what the impact that you're looking for. So just to say that it's not as straightforward as you might think is to just shift between taxes. In addition, note, as I mentioned already from the table, that the most volatile revenue sources are sometimes the ones with the highest historical trend growth rates. So 7% for the corporate, historically for the corporate tax, 4% for the individual income tax. This means that if you were to alter the tax mix in order to try to change volatility, reweighting that would often come at the expense of a higher trend growth rate. So this is another illustration of trade-offs among tax policy objectives, one that was examined by the 2008 State Budget Trend Study Commission, which started this work. Of which I was a member, and that informed by the work of Professor Stinson and MMB staff, the commission report discussed the trade-offs among tax revenue growth, tax revenue volatility, tax efficiency, the distribution of the tax burden. So the report notes that adjusting the tax mix enough to significantly reduce revenue volatility will impact revenue growth and tax system progressivity because the changes would have to be so large. It may also reduce efficiency through increases in the rates of specific taxes. So it's just another example of the trade-offs in tax policy. So if you want to move to the next slide, the one titled Minnesota's Revenue Volatility Has Increased Since the Mid-1990s, this chart shows MMB's estimate of overall volatility of the general fund over time, along with the most recent estimated standard deviation for the general fund of 4.3%. The estimates are based on current law and on analysis of the volatility of the bases of Minnesota's major taxes through 2012, which was at the time that this analysis was done, was the most recent set of tax data that we had. The chart shows that general fund volatility nearly tripled over the last two decades, from near 1.6% in the early 1990s to 4.3% in 2012. And this is something that Professor Stinson, my predecessor, had talked about in the past as well, and was part of the conversation of the State Budget Trend Study Commission. And in that graph, the vertical gray bars indicate the U.S. recessions. Moving on to the reasons for that change in volatility, the next slide is titled Economic Factors Primarily Drive Increased Revenue Volatility. So this more recent, especially the more recent increase in revenue volatility, we think is primarily driven by economic factors rather than policy factors, although there certainly are some policy factors at play here, in particular federal policy factors that that influence realization of capital gains, for instance. But first, for the reasons for this increase in volatility, several components of the major tax bases have become more volatile over time. So remember I said that for the general fund volatility, one of the factors is that the volatility of those bases. The negative shock from the Great Recession appears to have increased the volatility of the general sales tax and possibly also the corporate tax. The corporate tax base. In addition, we believe the increase in volatility of wages and salaries, long one of the most stable parts of the tax base, is due to the increasing importance of performance-based executive compensation, such as stock options and bonuses, which are tied to the financial markets and therefore are more more volatile. Also, our estimates of the volatility of non-wage sources of income, so the stuff that isn't wages, which includes capital gains, dividends, taxable interest, business income, and others, that lump of income, the non-wage sources, that volatility has increased also since the early 1990s. Note that non-wage income in general is much more volatile than wages and salaries. Despite the shift toward performance-based compensation, the wage component remains relatively stable with a volatility measure of 3.3%. So it has increased, but state remains one of the more stable components. Non-wage income, on the other hand, is three times more volatile than wages and salaries at 15.5%. Capital gains, with a volatility measure of 44.2%, is the most volatile tax-based component that we have examined. Other components of non-wage income, such as dividends, taxable interest, and business income, are 3 to 6 times more volatile than wages. So that brings me to the second primary point on that slide, the second overall economic reason for increased general fund volatility, and that is that those more volatile non-wage sources of income make up a larger share of income subject to tax. For example, 20 years ago, non-wage sources accounted for 24% of adjusted gross income on Minnesota tax returns, and that share has grown to about 30% today. The analysis that MMB does on revenue volatility is done in great part to inform the budget reserve recommendation that MMB makes each year. So on the next slide, entitled Revenue Volatility and Forecast Informed Budget Reserve Recommendations, we present that recommendation that appeared in our January 15th report. Every state revenue system has some inherent volatility, and most states manage the associated risk with some kind of budget reserve. So as I said, our most recent recommendation for the size of Minnesota's budget reserve was reported in the January 15th report. Our recommendation is that the budget reserve should be a percentage of forecast general fund revenues for each biennium, where that percentage is based on, recommendation in this report, on the volatility analysis of the current law revenue system that I've just presented. Therefore, the recommended dollar amount for the budget reserve may change because the general fund revenue volatility has changed, and that could be either because the volatility of those underlying bases have changed or because the tax mix has changed. And the recommended dollar amount may also change because forecast revenues have changed. Based on our volatility analysis, the assumption that the budget is, in addition to the assumption that the budget is structurally balanced at the start of the biennium, and the objective of limiting to 5% the probability that a biennial deficit will exceed reserves, MMB recommends a budget reserve equal to 5.1% of non-dedicated general fund revenues for FY14-15, so that's $1.990 billion, and 5.2% of non-dedicated general fund revenues, or $2.166 billion for the next biennium. That concludes my prepared remarks, and I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ursula Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Wouldn't, if we were to relieve the general fund of the property taxes and return that effort to the local units of government, wouldn't that be help them be stabilized and require less local government aid?
Dr. Kolomakidis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we have not analyzed the full package of all the revenue sources for local governments, and so I can't speculate about the impact on the volatility of their revenue sources if we moved something into their revenue sources, out of general fund and into their revenue sources.
Well, Mr. Chairman, what I mean is that if the state is grabbing some of the property taxes, and I think it's about $800 million on business and about $40 million on seasonal rec property, that money could better be raised and spent by the local units of government rather than the state taking it out of there. And then the state would not have to provide so much local government aid out of the general fund.
Dr. Kolombakidis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, again, I without examining the budgets of local governments, which is not the responsibility of our office, I can't speculate about whether that would be.
Thank you.
Representative Petersburg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Doctor, the previous slide you commented about the non-wage sources, and mm-hmm. I think primarily you said some of it had to do with capital gains and some of that, which to me kind of makes some sense. As we are increasing the number of retired people, they certainly will be, you know, utilizing and selling off some of their property and so forth. Is there any anticipated, I guess what I'm asking is, anybody determined exactly what that trend might be in the future? Because I think we're looking at larger and larger numbers going into the retired force that could impact that quite drastically, and I'm wondering if anybody has a forecast on that.
Dr. Kolombakidis?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, we forecast the we do forecast the revenues for the current biennium and the next biennium, and so we are paying attention to how income and revenue mixes change over time, at least for, you know, between these two biennia. We aren't forecasting way out, which some of the demographic changes are going to affect us for decades. And so what I could say is that we've considered everything that we know about the revenue mixes for this biennium and the next, and how the volatility of those mixes might change for those years. But we haven't forecast anything further out than that. But that's an interesting question about retirement. Another point about non-wage income and capital gains is that, and I think this has been true for other parts of the tax system as well, is that the Great Recession itself increased volatility, and recessions tend to. And so it will be interesting to see how things kind of settle out the further we get from the Great Recession.
Thank you.
President Petersburg?
Thank you.
Okay, I have the gentleman from Lyon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of a question. When you're looking at your volatility and the way you're setting that analysis looking forward, mm-hmm. kind of what part does like the Fed and like interest rate setting and some of those things when it comes to that volatility index, what kind of how does that play into your forecast?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, so when we do the revenue forecast, we certainly are considering what the forecasts are for interest and when is the Fed going to normalize monetary policy, when interest rates might go up, and we are considering the mix of the population that is retired, and so we're thinking about who's getting interest income and whether it's tax preferred and all of those kinds of things. Whether the stream of the source of income that is taxable interest, it has become more volatile. If it becomes even more volatile in the future, we're not speculating about that.
The gentleman from Lyon. Representative Barrett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, question for you about the slide that talks about revenue by source.
Yes.
Looks like the third biggest area there of the five are other revenue. And maybe you mentioned this already, maybe I didn't hear it, but what's the biggest part of that other revenue area?
Dr. Kolombakidis?
The largest, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the largest part of other revenue, it may take me a moment to find that. In fact, I don't think I have the answer to that right now. I can get back to you on that, though.
Doctor, if you'd follow up with the Vice Chair, that'd be great.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Vice Chair Barrett.
Would gas tax be a part of that, the other revenue area?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, these are only general fund revenues, and so the answer is no to that.
Okay.
I know that cigarette and tobacco taxes are in there, and there are other sources as well, but I can't off the top of my head remember what the largest
source is. Vice Chair Barrett?
So a follow-up to that is regarding your standards for taxing related to vertical equity, simplicity, equal treatment. Do you have those same goals for the non-general fund revenue areas such as gas tax?
Dr. Columbakidis.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, that's a very interesting question, because the way I see the portfolio of the tax system is that the tax system as a whole should be trying to balance and address those goals. And so any particular stream of revenue may be serving one of those goals but sort of violating another.
Sure.
And that may be a choice that we make as we balance that portfolio. So for instance, some taxes have as the objective to be progressive and tax people according to their ability to pay, and others may do a good job of addressing other social goals, for instance. And so no single tax is really expected, I think, to balance all of those goals all by itself.
Vice Chair Barrett?
Sure. Just a couple more questions. So regarding the gas tax, if you can, you're not here to talk about non-revenue sources, but how would you rate that as it relates to simplicity and vertical equity?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I actually haven't thought carefully about that in preparation for this, and so I'm really not prepared to answer that.
Vice Chair Barrett?
No more.
Representative McDonald, then I think we'll go on to some bills here, unless there's other members that have questions. We'll go to Carlson.
Yeah,
but Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kalamakidis, in order to achieve the recommendations that you put out to achieve the reserves, we would either have to raise revenue, taxes, or reduce spending, which would be less volatile, in my opinion. What is your opinion on that?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, members of the committee, the legislature passed and the governor signed a new policy that creates a procedure for increasing reserves in order to meet this target that says that at the time of the November forecast, 33% of any positive forecast balance gets added to the reserve, and so there is a procedure in place for that. That mechanism is in place for that to happen. There are opportunities to add to the reserves at other times if the legislature so chooses, but that's the mechanism in place right now.
Representative McDonald?
So what you're saying, really, the best mechanism, the best tool that we have to secure our funding, or to be less volatile, would be to reduce spending.
Doctor? Careful.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that when all states have some volatility in their revenue sources, and one of the ways to manage volatility in the revenue sources is through budget reserves.
Mr. McDonald?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I will go to Carlson, Lencheski. Anyone else who needs to be on the list here? Because otherwise we've got three bills today, but we want to have an open hearing here.
Yeah.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I wanted to go back, the comments about statewide property tax and how we compare. And I was sitting here thinking, there's kind of a flip side to that. And let me give you an example. These were local levies that the state historically took over for one reason or another. I was quite involved through the years with the funding of education, and our community colleges, if you go back a number of years ago, were funded by local levies, and the state made a decision to fund them with state dollars rather than off of local property taxes. The last one was the tech colleges. Some of them, or in fact probably all of them, had a local levy, and then when we created Minscu and merged, I think the price tag, if I recall, was something like $100 million. but that was the state taking over the cost of operating our tech colleges when they became a part of Minsky. There were other issues in the formulas and so on that drove part of that cost. But the only point I want to make that there is kind of a flip side when you begin to compare what states use their property taxes for. You know, in that case, that was local. We made the decision to take it over. So it gives, I guess my point is it gets a little complicated when you begin to compare what's funded with property taxes and what's not. The last time I looked at that issue, for example, and I don't know where they are today, but North Carolina continued to fund their community colleges off of local property taxes, or at least a significant part of it. And as you know, that would be a significant part of the state budget.
Chair Lencheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Professor, for being with us. And I had sent a note over to the nonpartisan staff to try to remember, and I could see them getting out the statute and reading it and trying to distill down how did we get to the volatility study, because I couldn't remember. But I think it's interesting for you, Mr. Chair, and for Chair Knobloch to think a little bit in context as you go forward and plan this year that Dr. Colin Makitas has referenced the budget trend study a number of times, and I was the chief author of that legislation. It was me and Senator Cohen that put a lot of these things into place, and I was trying to remember if the volatility study was required in law in the budget trend study, which the answer is it was not. It was from State Gov Finance, which is what Ms. Manzi and Mr. Michael were working on over there to try to get an answer for us to, you know, how did we get to even have to do this study? So I think, you know, the context for us as we look at revenue in this committee is to think is to also just think a little bit about what's the point of us even getting this study in the first place, and it all comes together in ways and means as well. In that, you know, just to go back, I mean, we passed last year in law, I think it was last year or the year before. You know, we have this new thing, and Chair Knobloch is going to benefit from this tremendously, where we just saw it when the forecast comes in, if there's a surplus, a bunch is taken off and dumped into the reserves. So we now have in Minnesota for the first time a system that builds the reserves, as we just heard Dr. Colin Makitas talking about, that there's a reserve-related issue when you're looking at volatility. If you're really volatile, you know, do you need more reserves? So Minnesota now has, and your new majority may want to undo that. I don't know, but we passed a law that says excess surplus of this amount goes automatically into the reserves and is going to help overall when you put the revenue and spending sides together to decrease volatility for all of us as decision makers. Now, some people would take the new surplus and say give it all back, and I'm guessing that's what we're going to see a proposal to do. But I think the volatility study should be viewed in the context of the whole budget trend study. And you know, one of the pieces I can't remember, and I think it would be helpful later for the chair of this committee and the chair of Ways and Means and all of us to know is how will the volatility study interface with the reserve question going forward? I mean, that's going to be something I think most people think we're going to get another positive surplus forecast coming up. Maybe not. But again, we will see a number, quite a bit of that money by law get directed right into the reserves. And you know, is this an annual study? I just don't recall, because what I heard back from Mr. Michael, Ms. Manzi, is it was passed in State Gov Finance. And I don't know how are we going to hear this again and again, Mr. Chair? I don't know. Or maybe Dr. Colin Makitas knows. I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lencheski, it's an annual study that we reproduce a report every January 15th, MMB does, along with the budget reserve recommendation that is based on a revised volatility analysis.
And, Doctor, you will, after the February forecast, these numbers hopefully get better, we're hoping. So your recommendation would change. Your recommendation stay the same. It's just the numbers may be different here.
Mr. Chairman, the recommendation is made once a year, January 15th, and we at the February forecast we will release new forecast numbers for the current biennium and the next biennium. But the recommendation does not get updated or revised until the following January 15th.
Representative Earhart.
Mr. Chairman, isn't there a lid on the amount of money that goes into the budget reserve from surplus? I mean, it stops at, what, $2 billion or around there?
Yeah. Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the statute, as I understand it, uses our, this MMB's recommendation as the target for the budget reserve. And so that the mechanism replenishes, adds to the reserve until we reach the target.
Well, I'm asking, Mr. Chairman, what the target is.
Mr. Michael?
What?
Or Ms. Manthe? Well, that's the recommendation. That's not a cap.
I think it's
I think it's you're recommending the whole thing. Yeah. Okay. So it's 1.99 and then 2.166. Okay. Representative Earhart?
No, I was just asking what the cap was. And I don't, Mr. Chairman, I didn't think it was annual cap. I thought it was an absolute cap. When it's $2 billion or $3 billion.
Well, Mr. Mike or Ms. Manzi, it looks like it's moving on us here. Is it inflated or inflator on it, Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, it's the amount that the MMB study shows that it is. So it's each year as they do the volatility study, part of that is that they set the target budget reserve amount. And so that will change over time depending upon the study.
So this is kind of an important study. I thought it was just another study. This actually matters. Wow. Any other questions for Dr. Kolombakidis? Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Kolombakidis, I don't know if I maybe wasn't listening closely enough or not, but these agency top score guidelines at the bottom of the last slide, can you kind of enlighten us as to what I know certainly that has impact on our bond rating, and that's maybe some of the wisdom or not behind the decision for the language that was put into law regarding this. At what point do you have to actually achieve the top rating in order to, or you know, do you have to be on their top score, I guess is the word here, in order for us to bring our bond rating back up, or can we still be an A at 90% instead of being at 100%?
Doctor?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's a very good question. How the state's credit agencies, bond rating agencies, derive their rating for state credits is a bit of a black box, so it's not specifically formulaic. However, they do provide information in some cases to say that we give full credit for this level of budget reserve. There are a lot of other things that the rating agency is considering, so that's not the only thing that they're looking at. And so I cannot answer the question of if we match their recommendation, what will happen to our rating. That's up to them.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Doctor.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Dr. Kolombakidis? Okay, with that, thank you very much for your presentation, and give Commissioner Franz my best, and I'll make up some bill where he's going to have to come here. So I haven't figured it out yet, but it'll be good to see him. So give him our best if you could.
Thank you.
Okay, item next, let's go House File 62, members. And again, this is for later for possible inclusion, so we will hear it. Let's go, where's my... Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, 61. What? Which one? We're doing 62 first. Is that okay, Chair Anderson?
Yes.
House File 62? Okay, House File 62. Chair Anderson moves House File 62. I see we have a Mr. Mark Gross here to testify. Is there anyone else on House File 62 that would wish to testify for the bill or with concerns? Don't be shy. Raise your hand. Why don't you get up there with him?
Well, I'm Mark Gross, but I thought I was a
piano. So
who's this guy?
He's part. They're both.
For 62?
For 62, yes.
Okay, Mr. Gross, why don't you join us down here? We've just doubled the testimony here, it looks like. Get the gentleman a chair. Okay, please present your bill, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if you will remember last year, for those that served on the Tax Committee last year, this was an issue that was brought up Mark Gross, that is with me as a business owner, a sole proprietor, that has brought this issue forward in that the R&D tax credit does not apply to sole proprietors. This issue was originally brought to me from Scott Schmidt. So this is Scott Schmidt, this is Mark Gross, as an issue that he is dealing with sole proprietors quite a bit on R&D and how this would be a benefit to the state and to job growth overall. So without having you hear from me, I'd like you to hear straight from them, maybe either one of you, whoever wants to start, Mr. Chair, if that's all right with you.
We'll go alphabetically. Mr. Gross, if you could start, please.
Certainly, sir. I'm a little sketchy on the protocol, but thank you, Chairman.
And I am too.
and representatives.
Mr. Gross, please proceed.
Yep. So my name is Mark Gross. My company is Formacote LLC. It's a 14-year-old sole proprietorship medical device company with 14 employees. The Department of Revenue considers my company to be a disregarded entity for the purposes of R&D tax credits. Formacote was profitable in 2014, but in part because of a previously large volume customer that we lost because we didn't have the right R&D before. But they came back to fulfill an order in the Chinese export market for medical devices. That profit came near the end of the year, and worked hard to try and preserve that profit, reinvest it, to sustain us in 2015, because we're still not quite reproducibly profitable from routine commercial sales. Our customer base is still growing in a number of customers, quantities of medical devices produced, and new commercial sales as customers gain regulatory approval. And so everything that we do as a medical device company, you know, it's R&D, and then there's this lag period. Well, companies get regulatory approval for their devices. A lot of times it's a couple years. When I was presenting last time, I was the poster child, and I did this, and my family laughed, but I still am the poster child, I think. It's R&D that we're still doing, trying to open up into new technology areas. We put coatings on medical devices, makes them slippery. And so products for us that both costs us in R&D, but endeavors to sustain us as we work in our own, again, without the state's inequitably applied help, not seen by us since 2011, when we probably accidentally received a Minnesota R&D tax credit. I still fear for them coming back to get me.
Well, I wouldn't be talking about it.
Yeah, I know. It's a risk. But, yes. But you know, it's how bizarre the situation seems to me.
Is Mr. Cummings in here? Could you please disregard that, Mr. Cummings?
I think he heard that last year.
Okay, Mr. Gross.
So this year we are paying state income taxes after a few years of losses and lean revenues. In a myopic view, our tax monies are going to pay for R&D credits for other companies that have done it, but not for us. I understand government isn't that simple, but especially with the previous presentation. Formacote and I really are still the poster child for why a disregarded entity for tax credits is sole proprietorships is inequitable. So we continue to just barely stay alive with previous R&D customers gain their regulatory approvals and start commercial sales and low startup volumes of new products. Eventually, those companies will sustain us with steady revenues, assuming we're still here. And what a mess for those companies, and hence the tendrils into the greater community, if they're not. I've continued to learn how the sole proprietor LLC, in spite of the state's prejudice against this type of entity, has been critical to my personal and corporate ability to withstand the 3 years of slim revenues and losses. The one leg of support is that I have these expensive variable whole life insurance policies that have cash value, and I've been using those to help sustain my company in the years of low revenue. Both of those are personal choices. Another leg is the carryover of Formacote LLC's losses into my family's personal income taxes as a sole proprietor. That all wraps up together. So those years I paid little or no income taxes, but that money actually helped cushion and allowed us to survive. And in case anybody happens to think that those years we lived normally without paying taxes, I'll have to pay those loans back that I gave to my company from those life insurance policies with after-tax profits. And it'll take several years to pay them back. So I'm glad that you've endeavored to try this again. It didn't work last year. Whether there's enough care or understanding in the legislature to go against the Department of Revenue's recommendation against sole proprietors and receiving the tax credit remains to be seen, but that's what you're all working on. This assumes that the Department of Revenue is still aligned against sole proprietorships because what I heard was it was too much work. We should keep in mind that sole proprietorships with employees qualify for federal IRS tax credits, not the owners. So my efforts don't even count, which means that maybe that's a way of distinguishing between just a guy doing R&D versus a company that has employees. Maybe that will help tip the scales in this situation. So I'd like to see an equitable treatment for R&D tax credits to act like a third leg of support for sole proprietorships and the individual risks that they take. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gross. We'll go to Mr. Schmidt, and then we'll open up for questions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name's Scott Schmidt. I am a part owner of a couple businesses that have ties or interests in the R&D tax credit. One of them is a software development company that actually claims R&D tax credits. The other is a consulting company that helps businesses across the country take advantage of the R&D tax credit. So I have kind of a national perspective about what the environment is like out there. And I will tell you from my practitioner perspective that it makes no sense to me why a company like Mark's would not be eligible for the R&D tax credit. Mark is doing the exact same types of activities that the folks at 3M do, any of the medical device companies that we work with do. It's the exact same types of activities, but for some reason he's not eligible for the R&D tax credit. I know that when the state decides to pass certain bills or put bills into law, there's financial considerations, and I will tell you that by far and away the majority of companies that we work with as practitioners are S corporations and C corporations. We work with very, very, very few sole providers. You just don't see it very often. So the point is that if sole proprietors were to become eligible for the Minnesota State R&D tax credit, I would tell you that the hit to the budget would be very small compared to what C corporations and S corporations claim. So I guess that's my comments. Thank you,
Mr. Schmidt. One question I'd have for Mr. Gross, have you ever thought of, and I like Chair Anderson's bill here, but it didn't go last year, and you know, we're taking another run at it this year, but what if you just became a subchapter S?
Well, I understand that question, and again, this is how I survived as a company the last 3 years. My company lost money the past 3 years. I borrowed money to the company to stay afloat. Those losses translated into my personal income taxes, so I didn't have any personal income taxes those years. I would have if I was an employee of a Chapter S or C Corp.
No, it's subchapter S would just flow through. The losses would just flow through the same as the
I
sole.
Still I have personal employment taxes that I would have to pay.
Mr. Michael, help me out here. If he was a subchapter S, wouldn't that work the same as being a sole proprietor in effect?
Mr. Chairman, I think the answer is you're both right. The point that Mr. Gross is making is that if he created an S-Corp and was an employee, then he would be liable for federal employment tax, the Social Security whereas a with a disregarded LLC, he does not have net profits, and so there's no self-employment tax that he has to pay.
And that's been critical to my survival the past few years.
I understand. Okay, questions for Mr. Gross or Mr. Schmidt? Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is more a kind of a curiosity question, but I've always been interested in research, although most of my involvement as a legislator has been on the appropriation side, funding for the university's research specialties and so on. But sometimes when we've had those discussions, things like copyright and patents come up. And how is that treated, or what's your philosophy when you're getting public funds, although kind of indirectly as a tax credit, in terms of your proprietary interests and how patents and copyrights are handled when public dollars are involved? And one of the reasons I asked that question, Mr. Chairman, my grandfather patented several things that were high-tech for its day, but he would be 131 years old. I just figured that out as I was sitting here, so it's a long time ago. But one of his products is still marketed today, but under another company. But at any rate, what is your philosophy on that, or how is that handled in terms of, because in a sense, your competition down the street is helping fund that tax credit, if you look at it in the broadest way, and should they have access to some of that proprietary information, or can you just copyright it and they have no, or patent it?
Mr. Gross?
Thank you, Chairman and Representative. So, I mean, right now I consider that since I'm paying taxes, I'm helping my customer, my competitors potentially, and not receiving that equivalent credit in return. In terms of proprietary knowledge, there is a route for direct government assistance to for R&D with the SBIR programs. And I did one of those once, and it just didn't work for what I was doing. In this case, as a general credit for R&D activities, it covers a wide variety of things. And so in some cases, they may be patentable things. Most of the cases that I do, they're trade secret proprietary elements, and I keep them that way because they're not really very patentable processes, for example. If it was a true product that we made, that would be different. And those have expenses and costs that I don't know whether they're R&D eligible. I doubt it, to patent something. But to do the true research and development, it's a support to what I do. It's not the whole thing that what I do. Otherwise, you know, I would not really exist as a sole entity. I'm not sure I got lost there, but this is just a leg of support. So how would you differentiate from what I do and whether it was state property or not? Because it's just one part. It's just a fraction of the cost. Does that help?
Chair Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I was interested in the philosophy as well as how it worked as a practical matter. So that you shared your viewpoint, I think that helps. Maybe the other gentleman has a comment.
Mr. Schmidt?
Well, I guess my only, you know, point would be is that, as I already stated, Mark is it looks just like a C corporation, S corporation, LLC. You go inside the building and they're doing the exact same activities. They qualify for the R&D tax credit, but Mark's for some, because he chose to be a sole proprietor, he's not eligible, but he has the same risk that all these other companies take. So and when we were here last year to work on this bill, and we talked with some of the historians within the Capitol, nobody knows why sole proprietors were taken off the list of as being eligible. In fact, we just found out this morning that actually at the very beginning, sole proprietors were eligible, and then sometime around, I don't know, 87, 88, they got pushed aside for some reason. So it just, from, you know, from my perspective, from Mark's perspective, it just doesn't make, you know, he looks like everybody else, except he's a sole proprietor, so he could be, should be eligible.
And sure, Mr. Chairman, the only reason I raise that question is if you have some discoveries and public dollars have been used, you know, who should have access to those discoveries. Other committees, mainly the education committees that have, you know, funded research and so on with direct appropriations, those kinds of questions do periodically come up. This is a little more indirect because it's a tax credit where those are direct appropriations. Most members here probably know the patent rights that the university holds generate some pretty big money for the University of Minnesota, especially in the health sciences area, you know, with various discoveries. But we've had some philosophical discussions about that. When public dollars are used for the research, who should have access to the research? And we've actually, years ago, had some legislation dealing with that. So I was only interested in your philosophy on that, as it would apply in this case with tax credits. But thank you.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. And on the floor, I'll come over. I want to know what products your grandfather patented.
I could tell you now, the one that's still marketed.
Yes.
One that he invented when I kind of was tongue-in-cheek. I said high-tech for the day. Many of you probably have at home the mop that you turn to get the water out.
Yeah.
If you Google Oscar Carlson, you'll see where he patented that. He had a factory on Washington Avenue North in Minneapolis manufacturing those mops. And
I've seen those. I've never used them.
Well, maybe you're talking about some gender issues there, but I have used them.
No.
But at any rate,
a next testifier, please.
If I may finish, though, then the Depression hit. And he was an immigrant from Sweden, and with great pride years later, and he did well on other things after that, but he had some huge debts, and so he sold his factory, he sold the patent rights, and with great pride as a immigrant new to the country, he said he paid every one of his creditors when he sold it. So he got out of the business sometime in the Depression era as a result of that. But he had other things that he marketed too. I won't bore the committee with those. But that's the one that I know that is still a version of it, at any rate, still marketed.
Still going. Okay.
Real Hop, I think, is the name of it today.
Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on this bill? Chair Anderson moves that House File 62 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you very much, Mr. Gross, Mr. Schmidt, and Chair Anderson. We will now move to, I think what I'm going to do is we're going to take House File 61 and 258, they're very similar, and we're going to kind of hear them both at the same time. They're very similar bills, and then, of course, we will Chair Anderson will be moving House File 61. We'll do that technically correct in a little bit, and then I'll be moving House File 258 for Representative Peterson. So if Representative Peterson would like to come down to the table here, and I have on my list Mr. Scott Schmidt, Ms. Beth Cadoon, Genevieve Plumador? Kyle Makitas, Vazinski, I can do them. Okay, and John Dukic? Dukic, is that cool? Okay. And then Genevieve Plumador was going to be on, it will talk about both of them. So I don't know if we can make some room down here for some folks. Oh, we'll come up as we go through. So let's start out with House File 61, and then we'll have some additional comments about House File 258. Then we'll get in testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or with concerns on House File 61 and 258? Okay, I think we know who we're talking with here. Chair Anderson moves House File 61. Well, we're not going to do the moving quite yet. Let's just talk about House File 61, Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But before I begin, I think Representative Peterson has a very important announcement to make to the committee.
Representative Peterson?
Mr. Chairman and committee members, I do have treats for you today, and I have a wide selection, including powdered mini donuts, and then if maybe a little bit more healthy is my daughter's homemade chocolate oatmeal cookies. And then if that's not healthy enough for you, I also have fresh fruit. And with
ooh, you can forget that.
Exactly. And
I'm going to go graze at a salad bar.
Mr. Chairman, I bought you your own personal bag.
Okay. Thank you.
And so I just was wondering if I would have permission to distribute that.
Why don't you have a page forward? Bring them up? I love treats and snacks. That would be wonderful.
Mr. Chair?
Ripner Dreskowski.
I'm just curious what's in the sugar. Or what's in the powder? Is it sugared?
Well, it better be. Pure cane, I hope. No, we like sugar beet. No, we like beet sugar. We like beet sugar better than pure cane.
Beet sugar?
Well, that trap. Okay. Thank you, Representative Peterson. Oh, this is wonderful. Little Debbie. I'll get my own?
Yeah.
Wow. I'll share. This one will go. We had a good breakfast this morning.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Now, thank you very much. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. For both of these bills that are before you today, they were both included in the omnibus tax bill for the House side. Unfortunately, when it went to conference committee, I blame the senators of taking them out of the overall bill. So what you're seeing here is a repeat of what we achieved last year, but just hope that we are more successful this year with it. And the R&D tax credit, as all of you know, this is a bipartisan effort for many years, has been a very successful tool for Minnesotans to use into attracting and retaining high-paying jobs here in the state of Minnesota. And so with that, I have some testifiers that can speak more to the details of that, Mr. Chair. And I didn't know if Representative Peterson wanted to offer some insight, too, as well.
Yes, let's go to Representative Peterson. I normally wouldn't do that, but sugar-coated donuts. How is your bill different from Chair Anderson's is what I'm kind of wondering about here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. The bill that we have under number 258 is sort of a two-pronged approach that looks at both the small business component and the Tier 1 that looks at the 10%, which I think is more or less very similar to this House bill that Representative Anderson is providing. However, the other Tier 2 that looks at also the corporate taxes increases it from a 2.5% credit to a 4% credit.
So that's the basic difference, the 2.5 to the 4.
I think in a nutshell, correct.
Okay. Okay, let's go to the witnesses, if that's okay with the authors. Okay, let's go to Mr. Schmidt first, and then we have three others. So we might want to be careful on the time here if we might get right to what we're doing here, and we'll go from there. Mr. Schmidt, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and committee. Again, as I just previously mentioned, I am part owner of a business that helps companies across the country take advantage of the research and development tax credit. We help companies. We specialize in both the federal and the state credit, so I have kind of a national perspective on where Minnesota stands. As you know, Minnesota was an innovator back in 1981 when it became the first state in the country to implement an R&D tax credit. Over time, many other states implemented state R&D tax credits, and as those credits came online, the Minnesota credit became pretty average. Nothing, you know, incredible about it. It was competitive, but it certainly wasn't one of the best credits in the country. Back in 2010, Minnesota made the tax credit refundable, and at that point, the Minnesota credit rocketed up to the top of the list as one of the best in the country. And so, as you know, the credit was refundable from 2010 through 2012, and in 2013 that refundable aspect went away, and at that point in time, then the Minnesota credit became very average at best. When you look at all the state credits across the country, the Minnesota credit from a rate standpoint is average. And you know, so it's an okay state credit, but the refundability aspect made it very good. As you know, credits are only good if you can use them, and there's a lot of credits. You know, a lot of companies in Minnesota can generate state credits, but they can't use them. Companies like Mark, if you're losing money, a lot of younger companies that are reinvesting back into their businesses, The companies get hit by the economy for whatever reasons. Companies aren't able to use the state tax the state tax credit. The refundable aspect was something that was extremely valuable to companies to be able to get cash back in the, back into that business. Many of the states, when you look at some of the states across the country and their credits, for instance, Pennsylvania's credit, you can sell it if you can't use it. So it's a way to monetize it and get some immediate benefit. Iowa's credit is refundable, another way to get money, some money back in the pocket. In California, you can apply the state credits against the alternative minimum tax and thus be able to monetize those credits. So many states have better, more valuable credits than the state of Minnesota has. North Dakota, small companies can sell their credits, like you know, young companies. So right now, again, our credit is average, but if Minnesota were to add that refundability aspect back to it, it would make it one of the best credits in the country again. So that's my comments. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. And I, you know, Minnesota, where all research credits are above average. But you're saying that would make it above average if these bills pass?
If it became refundable, absolutely, it'd be one of the best in the country.
Okay.
And just as a side note, if I could, it's also one of the more complex credits to calculate in the country. Many states have simplified their tax credit calculations, and Minnesota's is very antiquated and follows old federal rules. But that's for another day and another bill.
Representative Loeffler, to the witness.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you. You seem to be so knowledgeable about what's happening in other states. Are you aware of any, like, short- or long-term follow-up studies that have been done in those different states on what the real economic impact has been and, you know, whether there's differences in that result depending upon where the credit is targeted at?
Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler. There have been many studies done on the academic side of things. I have a study from a Federal Reserve Bank economist that talks about R&D tax credits across the nation. And what you can see in just a 1% increase in the R&D tax credit, the state will receive a 3 to 4% increase in economic activity. So it is definitely a tool that helps to grow a state's economy and attract and retain these high-paying jobs. We're not talking, you know, low-level jobs. We're talking significantly high-paying jobs. And I know some of the other testifiers will come forward. Average salary of $95,000. So for all those college students out there that we are encouraging to get into the science, technology field of STEM studies, we are going to be able to keep them here in Minnesota instead of seeing them go to other states.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you. I just wondered if different forms and processes had different results, and if you have any information on that. That was a good summary, but if there's more detailed information, that would be interesting.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to bring up with the testifier talking about, you know, the history of the refundability of the credit, just for some context. And, Mr. Chair, you'll do what you think is best, but the refundability of the R&D credit was a bill I carried and passed into law, and it did make Minnesota kind of the best at the time because it was a lot of money that was given from the public coffers to these companies. And for folks who will recall, it was a tax bill, and it was signed by Governor Plenty, and it was, we called it the jobs bill, but it had a lot of provisions in all kinds of areas of tax law to try to, you know, we were in the depths of the recession, we were trying to spur the economy, and many of them were designed to be temporary. This one was actually not. It was designed to be a permanent provision, and, you know, legislators often think that we can never repeal a tax expenditure, but, you know, we can. In fact, we repealed a tax expenditure to pay for the bill, and that's why Governor Plenty signed it. So, you know, it was quite a complicated bill with a lot of provisions that this committee worked on bipartisanly. And, you know, so why did it go away? You know, I also carried repealing it. So I'm the same person who both passed it and killed it. So you can blame me. And I just want you to know why. And I want, you know, my colleagues to know why. It's a very, very expensive provision, and we had a deficit. So, you know, I don't think people just think it's a great idea to take these things away necessarily. It's we had to make choices. If we didn't eliminate some of these corporate benefits, we had to raise more taxes on more people because they're not free. They're a tax increase on everyone else to pay for it. And if you look at the revenue estimate, this bill costs $100 million in biennium. Now, the refundability portion is a subset of that. That's about, looks like it's about $80 million in biennium. And that was really the reason, you know, the policy behind eliminating it. And so, you know, Mr. Chair, you will make the decision if you want to bring it back. But what I would ask folks to think about is, you know, these, who is getting these checks? These are companies who do not pay Minnesota taxes. That's what refundable means. A tax credit means you get a credit off your liability. A refundable credit means you don't pay state taxes. You just get a check. So, you know, I thought it was a good idea. I carried the legislation that we were going to write checks to these folks to get them to do stuff, and I think it really did work in the, you know, for what we were trying to achieve. But when we were facing a deficit, I couldn't justify that the taxpayers in Minnesota were going to pass out $80 million to folks who didn't pay state taxes. And so you'll have to make that decision. There is a surplus now, but I just think it's a broader thing to think about than just what the R&D folks want. It is other. It is the taxpayers of Minnesota, and these folks, to get it, have to not have a state tax liability. So just want you to have a little context. So thank you, Mr. Schmidt.
Thank you. Chair Anderson?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Schmidt would like to comment on that a little bit too. But I will tell you this for the state of Minnesota when it comes to refundability. It is such a tool used by the state to attract and retain businesses here that it was as late as October that our own Department of Employment and Economic Development still had that tool in the tool chest posted on their website as a means to attract businesses to this state, even though it was repealed back in May. And they still had it on their website. So when our own department views this as a tool to get businesses here, I think it's a good indicator of what this means to Minnesota. And I appreciate Representative Lincheski carrying the bill. I understand with the $600 million budget deficit that she was concerned and wanted to cut this provision. But we have an opportunity now to help especially small startup companies. These are mom and pop shops, folks, people that had ideas, took it to their garage, and now they want to take it to the next level. And I can tell you, I have visited countless number of these entities that are doing things that you can't even wrap your mind around. Technology that is our children are going to be using as if it was an everyday occurrence. And we are fortunate to live here in this state and to have that kind of innovation. But if we neglect and we ignore this opportunity to keep those businesses here in the state, I think that we will regret it years to come.
Very briefly, Mr. Schmidt, to the Lincheski comments, and then we've got other people that would like to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, and I appreciate your perspective. I understand the financial considerations when things are tough. But, you know, keep in mind that most of, you know, we're not Price Waterhouse. We're not working with the 3Ms and the Medtronics. We're working with the startups. We're working with the $5 million, the $10 million, $20 million companies that are all impacted and or competing or doing R&D in some form. Our Representative Anderson just, you know, alluded to the young startups, the high techs, the technology, the medical device companies. But the definition of R&D for tax credit purposes is much broader than that. So it's not just the high tech companies and, you know, the companies coming out with the revolutionary ideas. It's the plastic injection molders, the precision machining companies that are all competing, you know, head to head with all the companies in China and around the world. So all, you know, it R&D isn't just that new stuff never seen before in the world. Everybody manufacturing something or developing something is competing globally and with other states around the country. And I will tell you that many states around the country are absolutely making their working to make their R&D credits more competitive. And as I've already stated, many are more valuable than Minnesota's, and they're easier to calculate.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Okay, let's go to Beth Cadoon. And I want to make sure, if we don't get all these done, is anybody here from over 50 miles away? Other than Torkelson? Okay, we're looking forward to your brief testimony, Ms. Cadoon.
Appreciate that, Mr. Chair.
Doesn't have to be that brief. Yeah. I'm just kidding.
My name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to testify actually in support of all three bills that are here before you. Certainly appreciate the authors bringing them forward. We think one of the key strengths of Minnesota has been in the past has been innovation. This is why we've had such a strong and growing economy, and we've tended to outpace the national economy is due to our innovation. If you look at our Fortune 500 companies that we're so blessed to have and where we lead the nation with, I think, the 10th highest in the nation for Fortune 500 companies, second highest per capita, is what all those Fortune 500 companies have in common is they were homegrown. They were entrepreneurs. They were somebody who came forward with an idea, innovation, new product, new service, and they grew it into a huge company within Minnesota. We think when you look in the future and how we can continue our strong economy and what's going to be needed in Minnesota is how we can continue that innovation in the state of Minnesota. And that's going to come from those small companies that we were just hearing about, those startup companies, to be able to have that innovation in the state, do that research and development in the state of Minnesota. That's going to be so critical to our future economic success. When you're looking at putting a bill together, we think you should look at these R&D credits as one of those kind of strategic tax provisions that you can look at. Minnesota was the first state in the nation, is my understanding, back in 1982 that did the R&D credit. Since then, as you heard, many states have enacted one and now surpassed us. So when you look at those strategic tax decisions on how we can encourage R&D in the state, we think you really need to look at how we can expand this R&D credit. And we think you should look at how we can expand it for all our companies, small, medium, and large. And so I appreciate the authors bringing these bill forward. Thank you.
Thank you. I think if you could get another chair for Genevieve Plumadori, if you could stick around maybe, Ms. Cadoon, okay. Because I don't know if the members have questions or sit somewhere close here. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Genevieve Plumador, I'm here representing Life Science Alley and all of the medical device and biotechnology companies here in the state. I just want to thank you for the opportunity to come and speak to you about some of these changes in both of the bills before you that would help to make the R&D tax credit that much more robust here in Minnesota. As you know, Minnesota's economy has long benefited from strong research corporations, and Minnesota's R&D tax credit has leveraged investment dollars here in the state. This is evidenced by the strong ecosystem that we have here in the state. Our industry directly employs 48,000 Minnesotans, and if you include the provider and supply chain network that has grown around the industry, that's another 120,000 indirect jobs. So it's quite a significant footprint here in Minnesota. The refundability provisions found in both of the bills will make our R&D tax credit competitive once again. I provided for the committee a handout of some of the other states that we are in competition with who want to be the next medical technology hub. And you have states such as New York, you have New Jersey, Massachusetts, all these other states, their credits are way more impressive, way more robust than our credits. And other states are even looking at refundability as something to add on to their current credits, which are already that much more competitive than ours. You have New York and Colorado that both have bills this year that are looking, and they've called us and wanted to know how it had worked in Minnesota to try to emulate those programs in those other states. Of the 678 companies that are in the life sciences space that we represent, 79% of those companies have less than 50 employees. So as Representative Anderson alluded to, the refundability aspect of the credit is really to help those small companies who go through 5, 8, 10 years of an arduous FDA clinical trial process. And it's in their business model that they're not making any money during that time because they are reinvesting into their research, into their development. And the refundability aspect of that gave them the opportunity to have that money right then and there in that taxable year to reinvest in research and development, which could have meant another engineer, another scientist to help with furthering the clinical trial process. Additionally, raising the second tier of the formula as found in Representative Peterson's bill really does send a message that Minnesota understands the importance of the medical technology footprint here in the state. The credit could mean additional jobs, investments in research, and further collaboration with our research institutions. And these investments could potentially lead to the next greatest technology, as Representative Anderson alluded to. It's amazing. You know, I go to work every day, and I have all of these companies doing amazing, wonderful innovations and therapies that really are going to make a huge difference and continue to put Minnesota on the map. Again, just the average salary for employees in our space is $95,600. So these are high-wage jobs, and the R&D tax credit would help to continue to have those jobs be here in Minnesota. Today, with intellectual property, capital, and labor moving more mobile than ever, a competitive and refundable R&D tax credit is a critical economic development tool, essential to ensuring Minnesota remains a high-tech hub. So thank you for your time, and I can answer any questions if the members have any.
Well, thank you, Ms. Plumador. Stick around here because we're going to get all the testimony, and then we'll open it up for members' questions. The gentleman from the Minnesota High Tech Association, you join us, please. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Dukic. I represent the Minnesota High Tech Association.
Welcome to committee, sir.
Thank you. MHTA represents more than 300 science and technology companies across the state with the goal of helping Minnesota become a top five science and technology state in the country. And I'm here today to testify in support of increasing the second tier of the R&D credit and for the refundability provisions. As you know, the R&D credit plays an important role in Minnesota's innovation economy, particularly as we compete with states and nations to attract innovative high-tech businesses to Minnesota. And to put this in perspective, consider Massachusetts and California, which are already mentioned, and are routinely ranked as two of the highest innovation states in the country. These states have R&D credits much higher, much stronger than Minnesota. Massachusetts, for example, has a 10% R&D credit on qualified research expenses and 15% on university-related research expenses. California is even stronger with 15% on qualified research expenses and 24% for basic research. So strengthening Minnesota's R&D credit can only help us better compete with these states and others and other countries across the globe. But we certainly support making the first tier of the R&D credit refundable. This will only help entrepreneurs and startups raise the capital or keep the capital they need to grow their businesses in Minnesota while also encouraging innovation right here in the state. If we want a robust economy, we must encourage innovation at all stages of a company's development. And secondly, as I mentioned, the refundability, increasing the second tier making the credit refundable only helps our startups and entrepreneurs, as well as our large companies, help and attract a talented workforce right here in Minnesota. So with those remarks, I'd like to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Dukic. Any questions for Ms. Kadoon, Ms. Plumador, or Mr. Dukic, or the authors at this point? I think the committee pretty well understands the issues here. Okay, so with that, closing comments from the authors or Chair Anderson or Representative Peterson? Your daughter really makes wonderful cookies. They're delicious.
Thank you.
The fruit, that's really not appropriate for tax committee, but the other stuff, that was very good. Closing comments, Chair Anderson or Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Chairman, and I will make sure to never bring fruit again.
Thank you.
However, I do think others enjoyed some of that,
okay.
Including, yes, all right. The only other thing I wanted to point out that I failed to mention earlier is the other component that's a little different from Representative Anderson's bill to mine is that HF 61 is $250,000 and HF 258 is $200,000 for the refundability threshold, and so those two components please also take into consideration as well.
Chair Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just briefly, you're not going to see the large corporations being able to access this because odds are they're going to be above that $250,000 threshold. So this is really geared towards the small startup companies, those folks that are had an idea and are hopefully going to be the next inventors that we will be talking about on a day-to-day basis. So.
Thank you, Chair Anderson. Chair Anderson moves House File 61 for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. I will move House File 258, the Peterson bill, for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Chair Earhart.
Thank you. I thought Representative Anderson said these bills were bipartisan, but I see nothing but Scandinavians, Anderson and Peterson, on these bills. Is there something?
Chair Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Earhart, I would welcome you to sign on to the bill anytime.
Am I?
Is it by Scandinavian? Representative Earhart?
Well, I think I could skew it a little bit, not being Scandinavian, so maybe I should help.
Mr. Chairman, they must have included not included some Scandinavians, Carlson.
You still have the opportunity.
I guess so, Carlson. Yeah.
Okay, with that, folks, thanks for your work today. Have a very, very good weekend. Good government all the time. We're adjourned.